its rocky ridges and imposing character. We'll set off to find out more about the legend of the Grignard at 11:30. And before that, Hannah French explores Mahler's Symphony No. 8 in this week's Record Review Extra here on Radio 3 at 9:15. Before all that, though, time for Drama on 3. Tonight, as BBC Radio Drama celebrates its centenary, the acclaimed writer Katie Himms pays tribute to the form she loves. Here's Katie to introduce the play.
My name is Katie Himms, and I wrote my first radio play in 1996. And I have been writing for radio drama ever since. In fact, I have spent most of my working life writing radio plays, which has been a tremendous privilege and incredibly enjoyable. When I was commissioned to write a play that celebrated 100 years of BBC radio drama, I did a lot of research. I listened to interviews and I listened to documentaries, and obviously I listened to a lot of radio drama itself. And I found the experience very moving because it was almost like time travelling. And I think that was because there's a kind of teleportation element to a radio play, because it happens inside your head. It feels like you've almost gone to those places. You've gone back to the 30s, the 40s, the 50s. And I have tried to reflect my love for radio drama in this play, which is about the last 100 years of this medium. So really, this is my love letter to radio drama, and I really hope you enjoy listening.
Come Closer Now by Katie Himms.
Where are you? Where are you right now? Are you in your kitchen making toast? Or are you on a train or in a car? The way we listen has changed so much. We don't gather around the wireless anymore, do we? We're out and about, doing stuff.
Firstly, let's do a bit of the wind.
I'm just going to roll here.
Oh, I love writing for radio. I really, really love it.
Because
you can do anything. You can go all the way to Paris, all the way to China, and it won't cost you anything extra.
And we'll get the 414 in it.
It won't cost you any more than if you'd gone to Manchester, or Lewisham, or Torquay. You can even go back in time. Back 100 years, if you like. To a Tuesday in September in 1926. To London in a late heat wave. The first time they ever met, he fainted. Later, years later, he would deny it. He would begin to say it was her who had passed out. But I promise you, it was him. And you might ask, why does it matter? But it does matter, because it was a lie. And not the only lie he ever told, either.
Here you go.
Oh, thank you.
They say hot tea cools you down.
Yes.
I've never understood that.
I know what you mean.
You sure you don't want nothing to eat?
No, thank you.
It's too hot, isn't it? Too hot for food.
Yes, true.
But in fact, Connie Mortimer was too nervous to eat. She had a big day ahead of her, and she couldn't imagine wolfing down eggs and bacon and then going straight into the studio. Most likely she'd vomit the whole lot back up again, in front of everyone. The actors, the studio manager, the producer. And that would be it. Her career would be over before it had even started.
Excuse me?
Yes?
You don't have a light, do you?
No, sorry.
I seem to have lost my zipper.
Your what? Sorry?
My lighter, my zipper.
Oh, yes, I see.
He stood up then, with his coffee cup still in his hand, and he put a cigarette between his lips. She thought it was strange that he did this even though he had no light, and she wondered if it was a deliberate attempt to look dashing, and if that was the case, then he was fairly successful.
Oh, I can see it.
What?
Your lighter. It's under your chair.
Oh, well done.
Then he retrieved the lighter, lit his cigarette. inhaled deeply, and crashed sideways to the floor.
What happened? I don't know. He just collapsed.
The cup that had been in his hand was smashed, and the last remaining mouthful of coffee had spilt on his shirt, right by his heart. So it looked like he'd been shot.
He's not dead, is he? Gosh, no. Look at his chest. Rising and falling.
Oh, well, that's a relief.
Yes.
It's this weather, you know.
Yes.
We've had three girls go down like dominoes in the last 4 days. Nice-looking bloke.
I don't know what you're supposed to do with them.
With nice-looking blokes?
No, people who've fainted.
I'll fetch the girl who knows first aid.
Oh, yeah, a good idea.
When the waitress had moved off, he opened his eyes.
Oh, hello.
Hello.
Are you all right?
Yes.
I think you might have fainted.
How embarrassing.
It's the weather. They've had three girls go down like dominoes in here the last 4 days. There's no shame in it.
Yes, but they were girls.
But what difference does that make?
Surely... I don't need to explain it to you.
Wait a moment. I'm not sure you should...
No, I have to go. I have to be at the BBC shortly, and I think I need to buy a new shirt.
And then he left in such a hurry that she had no time to tell him that she too was working at the BBC today, that it was her first day, that it was a big day, that she was excited and terrified and also incredibly happy.
Where's he gone?
He just left.
He didn't pay his bill.
Oh.
Well, that's no good. That's no good.
Oh, Lord, and a cigarette. Where's the cigarette?
What cigarette?
He lit a cigarette and then he fell, so it must be here somewhere, still burning.
Eventually, they found the cigarette, which had rolled under a hat stand and was indeed still alight. Perfectly poised to set fire to a whole bunch of coats. No, hang on. There wouldn't have been a whole bunch of coats because there was a heatwave. Would there have been anything hanging on the hat stand at all? Probably not. But with the weather, as we all know by now, with the weather being so unseasonably warm, then the hat stand itself might have gone up. The whole place might have gone up in smoke. Might have become the infamous fire in Lion's Corner House.
Welcome, 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 everyone. How marvellous to see you all here. I'm the director. In a moment, we'll go round and introduce ourselves, and then we'll have a read-through, and then we'll have a bit of a chat about the play itself, and then we'll have tea. Mm-hmm. We've got 5 days to rehearse and get it all absolutely perfect. It's nothing to what you get in the theatre, of course, but the BBC can't afford to spend weeks on end rehearsing something that goes out on air once and once alone. But... the wonderful thing about radio as opposed to theatre is you don't have to learn the lines. Hurrah.
Hurrah.
But you do have to turn the pages without making a sound. More on that later. And of course, on the night you must master your nerves and not mess it up. I'm not joking. No, I am joking. Sort of. Shall we introduce ourselves?
Naturally, it turned out that the young man who had fainted in the Lion's Corner House and inadvertently nearly burned it down was also in the play. His name was...
Farley Sullivan.
It's a hell of a bump you have on your head, Farley.
Oh, is it?
How the devil did you do it?
I banged into a cupboard door in the kitchen while boiling an egg.
Connie tried to smile reassuringly, as if to say, your secret's safe with me. But he studiously avoided eye contact with her. In fact, he seemed almost annoyed to find her in the same room, as if she'd got through the door by following him there.
Why didn't you tell me you were in the play?
Well, I didn't know you were in the play, did I?
You just said you were going to the BBC. You could have been doing anything. You could have been doing all sorts.
Couldn't you tell I was an actor?
Well, no, not especially.
That's very disappointing.
Sorry.
So, what did you think of the read-through?
I thought it was rather good.
So did I. And the sad thing is, we're going to spend 5 days rehearsing, and we'll never get to be that good again.
Oh, don't say that.
No, it's just the way it is. It's the law of diminishing returns. 5 days of reading this over and over, and we'll all be heartily sick of it. And we'll be almost nostalgic about that read-through. We'll all think, damn, if only I could be that good again.
He was right, in fact. But how else do you prepare 14 terrified actors for a live broadcast? There was no way of recording anything in 1926. Sound effects were limited to what could be created by the studio spot.
ball bearings in a drum for the rain, a metal sheet for thunder, the classic coconut shells for horses. There was no stop-start. Can I do that again? No stumbling and taking it from the top. The green light flashed and it was go, go, go.
Connie?
Yes?
In this first scene, can you sound a little more femme fatale and a little less sincere?
Oh, yes, all right. Only...
Yes?
Well, I think at this point she is sincere, isn't she? I mean, she hasn't been corrupted. I don't think she necessarily starts out as a bad person.
She poisons her husband.
Oh, I know. Yes, later on she's rotten to the core, but in the beginning she's quite nice, isn't she? And, I mean, isn't it more interesting if she changes?
Perhaps, but I don't believe that's what the writer has written. And you can't start rewriting the play, I'm afraid.
It's quite difficult to imagine how it all worked then. I know they had more than one studio at Savoy Hill, and the director wasn't always on the same floor as the actors. And the same play was broadcast from several studios at once, in order to create different atmospheres or effects. It wasn't all detective stories and romance either. In 1928, a producer called Lance Siefking broadcast something called The First Kaleidoscope, and the announcer warned that...
I'm afraid what follows will be fairly alarming. A tumultuous noise will be unleashed.
Fragments of sound, poetry, the sea, choirs and lovers and Beethoven, cafes and battlefields. Possibly not much story, by the sounds of it. That wasn't the real one. We had to make that one up. Because the original was broadcast live. In May 1932, the BBC moved out of Savoy Hill and into the brand new broadcasting house at Portland Place. Apparently, it had a marvellous atmosphere and was full of false fireplaces, exotic plants, stained glass windows, ladies arranging flowers, and very good paintings. It sounds ever so grand, much grander than it is now. But still, I do love that building. I love seeing where they broadcast the news, and going up to Studio 60A, and maybe being in the same lift as Michael Rosen or Jarvis Cocker. But I'm wandering away from Farley and Connie, who are married now. The year is 1936, and Farley Sullivan has moved from acting to producing.
Hello, Nora.
Mrs. Sullivan.
Is he in?
Yes, he's in.
Do you think I could take him out to lunch?
Yes. Yes, he doesn't have anything booked till 3.
Oh, 3. Excellent. Can I keep him that long?
By all means.
Thank you.
But just tell me, how's Jane?
Oh, she's a darling. She's an absolute dear. She's with my mother this afternoon. They're at the zoo.
Oh, how lovely.
Yes. She's obsessed with lions at the moment.
Oh, well, that sounds promising.
Yes, doesn't it? I'd like her to be brave like a lion. To be lion-hearted, not like me.
Oh, I'm sure you're perfectly brave, Mrs. Sullivan.
No, you see, I'm not. Or at least I haven't been. I've been more like a mouse or a frightened rabbit. You don't get rabbits or mice at the zoo, do you?
I'm not sure.
Well, you might get rabbits, I suppose. But only if they were those extra large ones that don't look right at all. I've no idea if they have extra large rabbits at London Zoo. Do you know if they do?
I've no idea.
Should I knock before I go in?
This is an unexpected pleasure. Lunch with my wife. On a Tuesday, no less.
Oh, it started to rain.
Cue the ball bearings.
Yes. Poor mother and Jane are at the zoo. Oh,
they'll be all right. They can go and get a bun.
So long as she sees the lions.
Why is she so obsessed with lions all of a sudden?
Last night I dreamed that I was a cat.
A cat?
It was night, and I was walking along the rooftops of London, and there was this lovely big old yellow moon. And I had this moment of panic, thinking, what am I doing? I'm going to fall. And then I realised, well, I wasn't going to fall, because I wasn't human. I was a cat. And I could walk the rooftops of London all night long and never hurt myself. It was the most marvellous dream, actually. And I woke up with this tremendous feeling of freedom.
Should we order? Time is ticking.
Farley?
Yes, darling?
I wanted to talk to you outside the house. Because when we're at home, I don't think you can hear me.
I can't hear you.
No, you can't. You can't hear what I'm saying. I transmit and you don't receive.
Oh, yes, very good.
It's not very good. It's terrible. It's hellish. I need to work.
Oh, please, not this again.
I'm not happy.
Jane needs you, Con. She needs you.
Later, the waiter recalled that the gentleman had left the restaurant first, that he had hardly touched his chicken, and at one point it seemed he was crying. The woman sitting opposite him ate heartily, and when the gentleman had gone, she drank coffee and smoked 3 cigarettes while watching the rain. It was still pouring down, cats and dogs, he said, when she paid the bill. The waiter watched her leave and noticed that she didn't have an umbrella, but that she didn't seem to mind.
Can we not do the bang? I don't want a bang. Or a scream.
I don't even know if she screamed. I don't know what happened. I just know that she was hit by a bus on Regent Street in late September 1936. So many things happen in September. It's always a Tuesday in September, have you noticed? I know that she was 31 years old and Jane was 7. And I know that it was raining. And I know that Jane and her grandmother were sheltering in the aquarium at London Zoo, having already been to see the lions. And I know that Connie was killed immediately.
Where is she?
She's in heaven.
Where's heaven?
You know where heaven is, Jane.
No, I don't.
It's in the sky.
Will I ever see her again?
Yes.
When will that be?
When you die.
When will I die?
When you're a very old lady.
How do you know?
How do I know what?
I won't die till I'm old.
Well, I don't know. It's just what I hope.
So I might die sooner. I might die tomorrow.
I'm sure you won't die tomorrow.
I hope I do.
Don't say that.
Then I'll see Mother. Oh, we've run out of bread.
What?
For the ducks.
Oh, well, that's all right. They've had plenty.
What number was it?
Sorry?
What was the number of the bus that hit her?
Good Lord, what does that matter?
I want to know.
It was the number 59 to Camden.
Then I shall never, ever take the number 59 bus to Camden ever in my whole life.
Jane.
Yes?
Listen to me. You mustn't dwell, all right? You mustn't become a sad child. You must try your best at school, get plenty of fresh air, look on the bright side, eat your greens, keep your chin up, soldier on, all of that, all right?
All right.
You mustn't give me any trouble because I need to work. Need to get down to business, make a name for myself, forget all my worries, pack up my old kit bag, etc., etc. Do you understand?
Yes.
But she didn't really. She didn't even understand how her mother could possibly have been hit by a bus because she was always so careful to look both ways. And it was only when her father decided to write a radio play all about it that she found out anything more. But that was years away, years into the future. Before we get to that, we have to go to Evesham. Evesham, in September, of course, it's September 1939, in the era they called the Phoney War.
All right, I've just talked to Val and there is a plan.
Go on.
They're shipping the whole lot of us out to a stable in Worcestershire ASAP.
Worcestershire?
The entire BBC Repertory Company. Sound engineers, producers, me, you, the lot of us.
To live in a stable?
No, Nora, for goodness sake, no. We'll stay in perfectly respectable accommodation, but we'll broadcast from the stables.
Well, you could have said that.
I did say that.
Well, then you could have said it sooner.
Don't bicker with me, Nora. I hate it when you bicker.
Well, I can hardly bicker on my own, can I? Takes two to tango.
May I remind you that I am actually your boss?
Yes, you may.
I oughtn't actually need to remind you.
Yes, that's my feeling entirely.
What's that supposed to mean?
Nothing. Everything. Shame it's not Christmas.
Christmas? What's Christmas got to do with it?
In Evesham, we could do a marvellous nativity.
Are you taking the Mickey?
What about Jane? What will you do with Jane?
Jane? She'll come with us.
It turned out that Farley Sullivan was a terrible driver, which Nora felt she really ought to have anticipated. She sat in the front seat, fearing for her life and wishing she'd driven up with the actor Valentine Dial. An 11-year-old Jane sat in the back, surrounded by tins of ham. The actors were all paid 3 guineas a week and were soon known by the good people of Evesham as the guinea pigs. The studio in the stable had one microphone, one gramophone, no red light and no green light. The actress Marjorie Westbury spent much of her time being a human cue. Somehow, after a time, after months, when there were still no bombs and no invasion, the actors, in fact the entire BBC drama department, drifted back to London, back to Broadcasting House, where there were more microphones and everyone could sleep in their own beds. Until the Blitz began, and then everyone famously slept on the floor of the radio theatre in order to be ready for live broadcast. Then it happened. A delayed action crashed through a window on the 7th floor and came to rest 2 floors down in the music library. It exploded before they could get everyone out. 7 people were killed, but Bruce Belfridge carried on reading the news. He carried on, covered in dust and soot and ash. Extraordinary, can you imagine?
The story of recent naval successes in the Mediterranean is told in an Admiralty communication.
That wasn't the real thing, that was a recreation, recorded in the 1950s. When the war was over, Farley Sullivan wrote a play about his wife and cast his own daughter to play the part of her mother. Such a weird thing to do. But apparently, they sounded exactly alike.
So,
yes.
This is the green room, as you know.
Yes.
And this is Michael. Michael is on the rep.
How do you do?
I'm all right, thank you. How are you?
Yes, I'm perfectly well, thank you.
Michael will be playing Farley Sullivan, a.k.a. me. Because obviously I can't play myself. Well, I could, but then it would be impossible for me to direct the show, and I don't want anyone else cocking this up, do I? No. Plus, I suppose if I was being brutally honest with myself, I'm getting on a bit to be playing a man of 27. And obviously my daughter Jane is playing the character of Constance. So this is what we call a two-hander, which is rather unusual. What do you make of it, Michael?
Of the play?
Yes, the play. Give me your thoughts.
I think it's remarkable.
Remarkable in what way?
Well, I suppose there aren't many men who would write so openly about a personal tragedy such as this, if I may call it a tragedy.
Yes, I think tragedy is right.
And I think they're both very interesting characters. Constance is clearly fragile.
Yes, absolutely right.
But it's not overdone.
Do you know, the very first time we met, she fainted?
Yes, I think you might have mentioned
it. I used to find it terribly romantic as a beginning. But really, it was a sign of things to come. A sign of fragility.
I think the character of Farley, he's a man trying to do his best. Not necessarily always succeeding, of course.
Yes, well, I didn't want to make out that I was some kind of angel. It's important to try and be objective about one's own role in certain events.
So, yes, I'm looking forward to playing the part.
Okay, so that's probably enough chat. Time is passing. Let's have a read, shall we?
Sorry, can I just ask, before we begin...
What is it, Nora?
What about Jane?
What about her?
Jane, do you want to say anything about the play?
I don't think so.
Shall we get on with the read-through?
All right.
Excellent. Ready, Jane?
Yes.
You have the first line.
Oh, yes. Yeah, sorry. Last night I dreamed that I was a cat.
A cat?
It was night, and I was walking along the rooftops of London, and there was this lovely big old yellow moon.
Jane, what are you doing?
I was just saying the line.
Well, you're saying it all wrong.
Am I?
I'm going to give you a line reading and several pencils in different colours.
Right.
What I want you to do is to underline each word where the stress ought to be. I'll give you the line reading and you must repeat the line exactly as I say it.
All right.
Michael, I'll just read with you for a moment.
Yes, all right.
And Jane, I want you to start underlining the stresses.
All right.
Last night, I dreamed that I was a cat.
A cat?
It was night, and I was walking along the rooftops of London, and there was this lovely big old yellow moon. Jane, yes, did you get that?
I think so.
Well, show me then.
Say the line.
Yes, say the line.
Last night, I dreamed that I was a cat.
A cat?
It was night, And I was walking along the rooftops of London, and there was this lovely big old yellow moon.
Good Lord, Jane.
What?
You'll have to do better than this on the night, you know.
Not everyone gives line readings, you know.
Really?
Some directors simply trust the actor.
Trust the actor?
Basically, let one get on with it.
Oh, I see.
It's much better that way. It's the difference between being treated like a child and treated like an adult. I mean, one wants to make one's own creative decisions, don't you think?
I haven't really thought about... I mean, I've never even done this before. I'm at sea, frankly.
Well, frankly, it's a little bizarre, if not downright cruel, that you're having to play your own mother. The mother that you lost at the age of... How old were you?
Seven. I was seven. And I remember when they told me, I just didn't believe it.
You didn't believe she was dead?
I didn't believe that she could have been knocked down. Because she was always saying to me, don't forget to look both ways.
Do you remember her being terribly unhappy?
I don't. I really don't. Well, at least not when it was just me and her. She was marvellous. Very fun and very funny.
It's heartbreaking. I tell you what, I would never make my daughter do what you're doing.
Well, I could hardly say no.
Well, I would have said no if it was me.
But he wouldn't have asked you, would he? To play my mother, I mean. Your voice is just a bit too deep.
Ha ha.
Sorry.
Listen, you mustn't take anything he says about your performance over the next few days to heart.
But how can I not?
Your father is an absolute tyrant in studio, you know. If it wasn't you getting it in the neck, it would be someone else. He once took off his shoe and threw it at a sound engineer.
Goodness!
We all call Nora Saint Nora, because we'd never know how she puts up with him.
When it came to the live broadcast, Jane was afraid that the microphone would pick up her thumping heart or her chattering teeth.
Right, listen, this is important. Jane, you mustn't mess this up because my entire reputation is depending on this play and this play alone.
No pressure, then.
I can hear you, you know.
We know.
When the red light goes on, we're live and there's not a damn thing you can do about it. Follow your cues, concentrate hard, and Jane...
Yes?
Let Michael lead you through it like a dance partner.
All right.
Just between you and me, I am a terrible dancer. Oh,
so am I. I'm awful.
Excellent. Well, I'm looking forward to this.
Tonight, on Saturday Night Theatre, we present Woman in a Pink Coat by Farley Sullivan, directed by none other than Farley Sullivan. No one can say the BBC isn't getting its money's worth from Mr. Sullivan.
Last night, I dreamed that I was a cat.
A cat?
It was night. And I was walking along the rooftops of London, and there was this lovely big old yellow moon. And I had this moment of panic, thinking, what am I doing? I'm going to fall. And then I realised I wasn't going to fall because I wasn't human. I was a cat, and I could walk the rooftops of London all night long, never hurt myself. It was the most marvellous dream, actually. And I woke up with this tremendous feeling of freedom.
Huh.
Aren't dreams funny?
Indeed they are.
Farley.
Yes, darling.
I wanted to talk to you outside the house.
Oh, yes. That sounds serious.
It is rather serious. And it's terribly difficult for me to say to you, when you know, at least I hope you know, how much, how very much I love you.
I do know it, I do.
But the truth is I have these thoughts, these terribly alarming thoughts.
Connie, darling.
Don't judge me, please don't judge me, because you know how much it must cost me to tell you these things.
The play went down very well, and Farley Sullivan was lauded for his bravery. Afterwards, he put his daughter on the BBC rep, which was, of course, pure nepotism.
I always knew you were a cad.
I never pretended otherwise.
We'll be dashed. We'll be dashed to pieces on those rocks.
No, we won't. We won't. Not if I can help it.
Would you care for a whiskey and soda?
Don't mind if I do.
She was so happy, Jane. She felt as if she was flying. And then sometime in 1948, no doubt it was September, but I can't confirm that, something went badly wrong. She stopped acting, and she sort of vanished. Not literally. She didn't go missing in any
official sort of way, but it was like she went missing from her own life.
Presumably you'll want to cast Jane as Arena in your check-off.
No.
Oh, were you thinking of her as Masha? That might be interesting.
I'm afraid Jane is unavailable.
Really?
She's gone to Torquay.
Torquay?
Yes, Torquay. To take care of her great aunt on her mother's side.
How long will she be there?
For however long it takes.
Oh, pity not to have her in the check-off.
It can't be helped.
Do you think she might be back in time for the Agatha Christie?
No, I don't.
But that's not for another 3 weeks.
What can I say?
Poor Jane.
It's not poor Jane. It's not poor Jane. It's not poor Jane at all.
It's not poor Jane. It's not poor Jane. It's not poor Jane at all. It sounds like a nursery rhyme when you say it like that. I didn't know. I didn't know anything for a very long time. About Torquay. About 1948. I wish I had known. I think it would have helped. But I'm jumping ahead now. I'll go back. Back to the 50s. And we'll have to park Jane in her missing life, just for a moment. In the 50s, radio plays changed. They got radical. There was Beckett and Orton and Pinter too. Beckett wrote a play in which humans played ducks quacking and dogs barking. Magnificent. Afterwards, Beckett changed his mind and said he didn't like the human dogs and ducks. But it was too late, because it was recorded, and that was that. Things could record by then. When I first started writing for radio, I was given a cassette. A cassette of my first radio play, which, of course, like an idiot, I've since lost. That was in 1996. But I'm jumping ahead again. In the 50s, Dylan Thomas wrote Under Milk Wood, the sublime, unbeatable Under Milk Wood. I heard a gorgeous story about another writer recently. This writer, who is apparently obsessed with Under Milk Wood, was working in 60A, which is the studio at Broadcasting House, and the studio manager said to this writer,
"See this? This is the actual door they used in Under Milk Wood."
The real actual door?
Yeah.
Are you joking?
No.
I mean, you're not winding me up.
Of course not. Listen.
Wow.
And then this writer stroked the door and started crying. And I can completely understand that. My mum, Jane, missed all this. Pinter, Beckett, Orton, Under Milk Wood, when she could have been right at the heart of it. Eventually my mum became a writer herself, although she always says she went round the houses to get there because she spent 15 years as an English teacher in an all-boys grammar school in Manchester before she even got started. Oh, can I just tell you this story about Dylan Thomas before I tell you about my mum? Dylan Thomas played Private Di Evans in David Jones's epic poem about the First World War. The director asked Dylan Thomas to scream as the shelling rained down on him, and he obliged by making the most blood-curdling sound. All the men in the studio stopped doing their crosswords, and all the women stopped knitting. And then Dylan Thomas turned to Richard Burton and said,
"I bet you can't do that with a fag in your mouth."
In 1963, my mother was 35, unmarried, childless, apparently, teaching English literature in the aforementioned grammar school in Manchester, when she wrote her first radio play. A ghost story.
You were wrong about Mummy, you know.
What do you mean?
I did see her again.
Did you? When?
I had a dream about her.
Oh, I see. Well, I hope it was a nice dream.
It was a very nice dream.
Good.
We've run out of bread for the ducks.
Oh, yes. Well, never mind. They've had plenty.
But then last week I saw her again. I saw her across the street.
Well, that wasn't Mummy, darling. That was someone else. Were they in a pink coat?
Yes. How did you know?
Because you saw the pink coat, and that made you think of her. And probably her hair was a little bit like Mummy's too, and you thought it was her. I expect this lady wasn't nearly so pretty.
Oh, but she was.
She was exactly as pretty as Mummy because she was Mummy.
Janet, please.
She waved at me from across the road, and she smiled.
Listen to me, Janet. You mustn't dwell, all right? You mustn't become a sad child. You must try your best at school. Get plenty of fresh air. Look on the bright side. Eat your greens. Keep your chin up. Soldier on. All of that. All right?
But, Daddy...
What?
Yesterday, she actually spoke to me.
She spoke to you?
On the school field.
What did she say?
It was an accident.
What was an accident?
That's what she said.
It was an accident.
I forgot to look both ways.
The play was recorded at the BBC studios in Manchester at Broadcasting House by Piccadilly Gardens. A grown-up played Janet. That's why she sounds so strange. Grown-ups often play children in those days. Sometimes they still do, and I always dislike the effect of it. The famous Billy Whitelaw, Beckett's favourite, she played a lot of boys, apparently, when she was starting out. She said she was jealous of Judith Bradshaw getting all the lovely girls' roles. Grown-ups playing children. Posh women playing char ladies. Southerners playing northerners. You can always hear that something isn't quite right. There's so much in the voice. Just the voice.
Jane.
What's wrong?
What the hell do you think you're playing at?
Sorry?
Don't pretend, Jane, for God's sake. I've just been listening to your so-called play.
Is that why you're calling me?
Your mother. Your mother knew exactly what she was doing when she walked straight into that bloody bus.
You said you didn't know what she was doing. You said she was out of her mind.
I mean, it was a deliberate and successful attempt to take her own life.
I don't think that's true. Or I don't think that's definitely true.
How would you know? You don't remember. You don't remember anything.
I remember all sorts.
You were seven.
I remember arguments.
What arguments?
You and my mother.
You can't. You can't possibly remember that.
It's been bothering me for years, actually. This question mark. So I wrote to Nora.
Ha. Huh.
And she wrote back.
Dearest Jane, how very lovely to hear from you. I'm delighted to hear you're thriving in Manchester. I myself am quite well and enjoying retirement after so many years at the BBC. About your wonderful mother. As you know, there was never an official verdict on the cause of her death, and I'm afraid I often had my doubts about your father's version of events. She did not strike me as a woman who wanted to die. She loved you so, and she loved life. I fear that she only wanted to leave your father, not you, and not this world.
Letters work very well on radio, I believe, although I know some writers don't like them and consider them cheating. A bit like voiceover. A bit like this.
Did you think it was any good? The play, I mean.
I thought it was exploitative, derivative, and disgusting.
Well, at least I gave my characters different names.
This was 1963. Farley Sullivan didn't speak to her for another 17 years. 17 years in which Jane continued to teach, continued to write and continued to thrive. But I just wanted to let you know, I did actually meet my granddad, Farley Sullivan, before he died. It was 1982. My mum and him made their peace and he gave me a Ferrero Rocher and let me watch The Dukes of Hazzard. So he can't have been all bad. In 1971, my mum wrote a radio play in which she also acted with my dad.
We have to go back.
We can't go back.
We have to try.
We can't go back, I tell you. It's impossible.
Don't say that.
Well, it's the truth. And the sooner you get that into your head, the better it will be. The better it will be for all of us. You can't be selfish about it. Not on a spaceship. Not when we depend on one another like we do. If one of us goes down, we'll all go, like dominoes. Then how the devil will we get back to Earth? Tell me that.
I've no idea.
Exactly. So grow up and stop thinking of yourself.
I wasn't thinking of myself. I was thinking of the boy.
Then stop thinking of the boy.
I can't.
He's gone. He's lost.
But he isn't. He's the opposite of lost, since we know exactly where he is.
Look, I'm not completely heartless, you know.
It's tough, it is, but at least he'll survive.
He'll survive?
He can fend for himself. He's not a baby.
He is a baby.
He's 8 years old and he has enough food and oxygen to last him a lifetime.
But he won't have any people. He won't have any love.
He doesn't need love to survive.
Of course he does.
You know, eventually someone will come along and pick him up, don't you?
When? When will this happen? It might be years.
Yes, most likely it will, but the point is he won't be there forever. Some sort of ship will be passing and they'll fetch him up and they'll bring him home.
And by that time, we'll be long gone. We'll be dead, in fact.
Well, yes, of course, naturally.
Oh, I can't bear it. I can't bear to think of him all alone.
What you have to do is convince yourself that in actual fact, there is no boy. And there never was.
What are you talking about?
I can give you a pill for that. Take one pink pill a day for 3 months, and very quickly, he'll start to fade.
But I don't want him to fade.
It's for the best, Jane.
The best for who?
At the end of the 3 month course, you might have this vague impression of a person. A pair of laughing brown eyes, or a toy train or something. But you won't be able to place those eyes or place that train.
That sounds horrific.
Then you take a maintenance pill once a month to top up the amnesia. And you can live the rest of your life like that. It won't do you any harm. Go and see the ship's doctor. Tell him I say it's all right and Bob's your uncle.
You're mad if you think I take a pill like that. You're insane.
Well, either you take the pill by choice, or we can knock you out and administer an IV.
I don't know how old I was when I first listened to this play, but I was definitely a kid. They had it on cassette. I listened to it over and over, but I didn't pick up the clues then. It's funny hearing it again just now because it's so clear what she's writing about, but at the time, I was just listening to my mum and dad being in a play. I probably didn't like how mean my dad was being to my mum, but I also knew it wasn't real. Not just because I knew it was acting, but because he was quite literally the kindest man on the planet.
Good Lord, what are you doing?
Turn the ship around.
I can't!
If you don't do it, I'll shoot you.
You'll shoot me?
Yes.
If I turn this ship around, then we'll never make it back to Earth.
But we will make it back to him.
It will take years.
What if we could find a wormhole?
A wormhole?
What if we could find one of those and we could somehow use it to slip back to that time, that planet? You know, the kind that Einstein talked about.
Einstein was full of hot air.
Einstein was a genius.
You've got to stop this. You've got to drop this.
You're such a bastard.
Sorry. Can we say that? Can we say bastard? Is that allowed?
Well, he is being a complete...
Oh, yes, no, absolutely he is, I agree. But can we say it on air?
I think it'll be all right.
Do you want to record one with and one without?
No.
You're taking a bit of a risk, aren't you?
It's still not easy to swear on Radio 4. It's a bit easier on Radio 3, but there are no guarantees. Mind you, nothing is so tricky as blasphemy. My God, blasphemy is frowned upon. It really upsets people. Most of the time, it's not worth it. Oh, my God, is the worst one for me. Having to ration it so much because it's part of the rhythm of modern speech. It's part of the vernacular. I've reached for it over and over again and then had to cut back later.
Shall we go again?
From the top?
No. Most of it was very good. Till Michael stopped.
Oh, sorry. Sorry. I should have just carried on, shouldn't I? I just thought maybe it was one of those swear words you meant to take out, but then you never got round to it.
No, it was very deliberate.
Sorry.
No, quite all right.
Shall we take it from Q6?
Einstein was full of hot air.
That's right.
I don't think he was. Full of hot air, I mean.
I don't think he was either. That's why I'm giving the line to you.
Thanks a bunch.
Hang on. We're having a slight technical hitch here. Hold your horses.
No problem.
All right.
God, it's so lovely to see you, Jane.
That's lovely to see you too.
I can't believe it, really. I can't believe that you're writing, and we're here, and we're acting. Me and you. After how long?
23 years.
I never understood why you abandoned us on the rep.
No.
You had your reasons, I suppose.
Yeah, I did.
Sorry. Didn't mean to pry.
No, it's perfectly reasonable. To wonder.
It must have seemed very odd. To everyone.
I wrote to you. But you didn't write back.
No.
Okay, sorry about that. We're ready.
Where from? Sorry.
Q6, remember? Bloody amateurs. Right, I'll give you lies.
Okay.
Can we go out for dinner after this? It's just so lovely to see you.
Yeah, it's very lovely to see you too.
Can you two shut up?
Einstein was full of hot air.
Einstein was a genius.
You've got to stop this. You've got to drop this.
You can do anything on radio. You can go all the way to Paris. All the way to China. You can even go to outer space. And it won't cost you anything extra. It won't cost you any more than if you'd gone to Manchester. Or Lewisham. Or Torquay. It was 2018 before I discovered what was behind that play. About a boy left behind.
Oh, Mom, your office.
What's wrong with it?
It's mental.
Mental? I don't think so.
No, it is. I don't know how you find anything. You haven't got any room on your desk.
I know exactly where everything is.
It's like a hoarder's office. It's like a crazy person's office.
I like it. I feel happy in chaos.
Oh, and it's dirty. It's covered in crumbs and you'll probably get mice or maybe worse, rats.
Oh, Annie, I'm sure I won't get rats and mice. Well, mice are quite nice, I think. They're so tiny.
I think we should have a clear out.
I don't want to clear out.
I'm actually worried it's sort of a fire hazard.
Oh, rats? Fires? You're a catastrophist. Haven't you got other things to do?
Yeah, of course I've got loads of things to do. I've got 3 deadlines and 2 kids, a husband who's shagging someone else and an elderly mother who's a crazy hoarder.
Is he doing it again?
I don't know. Well, I don't know.
The problem is that you married a womaniser.
Mom, no one says womaniser anymore.
Britney Spears wrote a song called Womaniser.
Yeah, no, she did, but that was about 10 years ago.
Well, that is quite current for me.
No, it was a good comeback.
Oh, thanks. Well, have you asked him?
Well, he's not going to admit it, is he?
He might. He might just want to come clean.
Unlike you.
What's that supposed to mean?
It was a joke. About the state of your office.
Oh.
I do, in the end up having a bit of a clear out, and I find a cassette labelled 1988. I think it must be a play that I haven't heard. My mother has gone to the shop to buy tonic water so we can drink gin and talk about my lousy marriage. I press play and this is what I hear.
I can't find you. I can't find you. Where are you? Please don't be dead. I can't bear it if you're dead. I just can't. I'm sorry. About what happened. I've looked and I can't find you. And now they tell me that I'm dying. I have cancer.
This is my mother's voice, but I think she must be acting. I rewind to the beginning, which seems to take forever. My heart is beating weirdly fast.
Year is 1988. It's September. September 17th, in fact. It's raining, and my name is Jane Sullivan. I'm 59 years old. Well, sorry. I want to say how sorry I am to you. You might not believe this, but I have tried to make this recording so many times. I wanted to find the right beginning, but I've come to the conclusion that I have to simply begin, which I ought to know by now. Jump in or you will have nothing. down instead, but I don't want you to read an essay, especially if I'm already dead. I mean, with someone's voice, you've really got something, haven't you? You've got a tiny part of them at a very precise moment in time. And you can play that moment over and over if you want to, if you need to. I have nothing of you. And I often wish I'd cut the tiniest piece of hair. You had lots of hair and very dark eyes. You were very beautiful. I want you to know that it was unbearable handing you over. I sometimes think I should have fought to the death. But in that moment, there's no one who will help you. There's no ally. You're fighting alone against an army, against the whole world. Darling boy, forgive me. I can't...
Oh, sorry I took so long. They only had slimline toy at the off-license, and I hate that, so I walked to the other one. What is the point in shaving 17 calories off a perfect drink and rendering it imperfect for the sake of 17 calories?
Mum.
What's wrong? Darling?
I just listened to something.
What?
A tape.
What tape?
This tape.
I can't find you. Where are you? Please don't be dead. I can't bear it if you're dead.
Stop.
I just can't.
No, stop it, please.
Is this real? Sorry, Mum.
No, don't apologise.
I shouldn't have played it. I thought it was a play. It's not a play, though, is it?
No.
I didn't even know you had cancer. You didn't even tell me that.
Because you were in the middle of your GCSEs.
But you could have told me, Mum.
I wanted you to do well. And you did. You did do well.
What was his name?
He didn't have a name.
What do you mean?
I wasn't allowed to give him a name.
Why weren't you allowed to give him a name?
In case I got attached.
Mum.
Shall we have a drink? I think we need a drink.
Some people listen to the radio late at night to fall asleep. Sometimes people say to me, I was listening to you and I fell asleep. And when I woke up, it was over, but I caught your name. Not much of a compliment, is it? I was listening to you and I fell asleep. But if I'm lucky, someone will tell me that they couldn't stop listening, that they had to stay awake till the end, or that they couldn't get out of the car, or they had to stop cleaning the bathroom or whatever and just sit and listen. A play goes out on the radio and we have no idea who is listening. No idea at all. The first one I ever wrote was broadcast in March 1997. It was recorded in Manchester at the BBC on Oxford Road. I remember putting loads of sound effects into the first draft that we didn't need, just because that's what I thought you were supposed to do. I should have known better. I've got no excuses. I was 24 years old, a drama graduate, daughter of an actor and a writer who had entirely failed to rebel and become an accountant or a zoologist or a Tory. Here's the beginning of the play.
She's doing it again.
I know.
And right under the sign, again. I swear she does it on purpose.
I don't think it's malicious.
She's getting crumbs everywhere.
I'll get the vacuum cleaner out at 5:30.
She sets such a bad example. I'm not just talking about the sandwiches.
Are these to go back on the shelf?
Oh, here she comes. Will you tell her, Edie, please, now?
Mrs. Penny. Mrs. Penny. Please, could you not eat your sandwiches under the no-eating sign? You see, eating's not permitted in any part of this library. Thank you. Thank you for your cooperation. Only Mrs. Penny doesn't cooperate. She smiles at Edie and nods, but she puts her sandwiches away in her mouth. Then she says,
I'm finished now.
She has horrible, wrinkly tan tights, but a lovely green hat.
I have to remind you, Mrs... What's her name?
Penny. Mrs. Penny.
I have to remind you, Mrs. Penny, that we are not a cafeteria.
She smiles at the supervisor because that's what she's like. She couldn't care less, and Edie admires that. Are you renewing these or bringing them back?
I'm renewing.
6 months you've had that out on loan. Why don't you try something different? George Eliot is very good.
Is he pornographic?
No, he's not. Not really.
I think I'll stick with the one I've got if it's all the same to you. Thank you very much.
Oh, it's very strange hearing that again. Except it's not the original recording, it's a recreation. Which you don't really get in radio. Different versions of the same piece. Not like in the theatre, where there might be many versions of the same play done over and over. Jean Alexander played Mrs. Penny in 1997. Jean Alexander, who was iconic as Hilda Ogden. In Coronation Street. Those curlers wrapped in a headscarf. I loved her as Mrs. Penny. The whole studio experience was magic. At the end of the recording, the producer produced a bottle of champagne and we all raised a glass. This has quite literally never happened again. In 27 years, I'm not complaining. No one writes radio plays for the champagne. I've written radio plays mainly for happiness and just about enough money to live on. Some plays, naturally, have been easier than others. I once agreed to write a radio adaptation of a silent film, which was very tricky, especially because I hadn't watched the film before I said yes, and so I didn't know that I would hate how it ended.
I didn't want anyone to see me.
I wrote another radio play in which a woman breaks down when recounting the day she abandoned her baby in a phone box.
So I left her there. I kissed her goodbye. First.
Oh, my God, this is amazing.
Shh. Do you mind? Do you mind me telling you this? I've never told anyone. I've never told anyone in my whole life. Sorry. Sorry. Can we stop?
You okay?
Yeah. I'm not acting. That wasn't acting. Sorry, I lost it.
We used the tape with the real crying because it's too good to waste. Which sounds a bit heartless, doesn't it? A lot of the time we don't know where our stories come from and it's only afterwards that we can say, oh, that's what it was all about. I told a lot of stories about a lot of lost babies before I ever found out about my mother and Torquay. I didn't often write directly about my own life, believe it or not, although I wrote a really mean play once about an ex-boyfriend. And I was sort of terrified he'd hear it.
That was a lovely read-through. Thank you so much, everyone.
It's a very funny play. It's great.
Oh, thanks. Thank you.
He's such a wanker, isn't he?
Oh, he's not. He's not, not really.
The actor, of course, thinks I'm talking about the character.
So then how do you want me to play him?
Oh, no, you're playing it perfectly. You're absolutely perfect. I just meant, I suppose he doesn't think he's a wanker.
Well, no one ever does.
I don't think I've ever been allowed to say wanker on Radio 4. But this is Radio 3, so you can say anything. That's actually not true. But after my meme play went out on air, a couple of months after, I bumped into the real version at a train station, London Bridge, in fact, in February. And it was snowing, so it was more like a film than a radio play. If it had been a radio play, it would have been raining. Maybe we'll just have it rain anyway.
Annie!
Dan!
How are you?
Yeah, fine, thanks, you?
Yeah, fine.
Good, that's good.
You look well.
Do I?
I heard you play on the radio about us.
Oh, right. Oh, yeah.
You made me a bastard.
I didn't make you a bastard.
I wasn't nice.
Yeah, no, you weren't nice.
Also, I was a bit thick.
Sorry. I mean, it's because it's not you. It's a composite of you and someone less nice and more thick than you.
And I never said that stuff.
You did say some of that stuff.
Well, you said stuff too.
Yeah, but yeah, I know. I'm sorry.
Maybe I should be flattered.
Well, that is one way of looking at it.
I mean, I would have been if he wasn't quite such a bastard and quite so thick. But apparently the sex was quite good.
Sorry?
In the play, the character was quite good at shagging.
Yeah, yeah, I might have exaggerated that bit.
Oh, right, thanks.
Sorry, Dan, you are. You are much nicer than him, honestly. You're a nice person, you're just not a very good boyfriend, you get bored.
I don't get bored.
You do get bored, and maybe that's fair, maybe I'm really boring. But you have got bored of quite a lot of other women too, so I'm thinking that it's you, not me sort of thing.
Do you want to go for a drink?
When?
Now.
Now?
Yeah.
Aren't you really pissed off with me?
I mean, yeah. No, but might be nice, you know, go for a drink, catch up.
Have sex?
I didn't say anything about sex.
I just want to be clear that I know where this is going and I'm fine with it.
Where is it going?
We'll get together for a couple of months and for the first fortnight or maybe just the first week you'll think you want to marry me, but then you'll go off me really fast.
Oh, that's so unfair.
It's like that dust.
What dust?
In A Midsummer Night's Dream, when that magic dust has worn off. But you'll let it drift on for about 3 months because you feel guilty. But by June, you'll be really bored, and by August, you'll have chucked me.
Jesus Christ.
Well, we can't say Jesus Christ on air.
Well, we're not on air, are we?
No.
Sorry, I'm just a bit lost now. Because, I mean, according to you, I'm even more of a bastard in real life than I was in the play.
No, I don't think so. I don't like feeling stupid, so I'm just saying how I think this is going to go.
Yeah, but now I don't feel like going for a drink at all.
Okay, well then that's easy, isn't it? We don't go for a drink and we don't get to hang out and the rest. And that's a bit of a shame.
That is a shame.
But we'll both survive.
What if I want more than a couple of months?
You won't, I know you won't.
What if I really want to marry you?
Damn.
I mean it.
I know you mean it. You definitely mean it right now. But in about 10 days...
Don't say that.
I'm sorry, I'm not trying to be a cow. I really like you. I like you a lot. I just think you're feckless.
But that's horrible.
Of course we end up going for that drink. But by August, we're not splitting up. We're getting married. And now, I think that was just Dan trying to prove to me that he wasn't the feckless bastard I'd written him to be. The marriage lasts 17 years, produces two fantastic boys, and you know how it ends because I've already told you.
Oh, I did like him, you know.
Well, he's very likeable.
Oh, it's sad.
He's not dead, Bum. You can still see him.
I know, but it's not going to be the same now you're divorced, is it?
I bloody hope not.
Do you have to swear?
That's not really swearing, Mum. That's like nothing.
It's swearing to me.
Well, I'm sorry.
No, you're not.
I am.
Do you think Dan will still do the gardening?
The garden is too big, Mum.
That's why I need Dan.
No, you need to move. The garden is too big. The house is too big. It's insane that you still live here.
I'm not ready.
Mum.
Now, don't be cross with me.
I'm not cross with you, but you're 93 years old. You're nearly as old as radio drama.
Well, not quite.
No one lives on their own at 93. It's not safe, Mum.
There are so many repeats now.
What?
On Radio 4.
You're changing the subject.
I'm not. You just said about radio drama.
Mum.
Loads of your stuff has been on.
I know.
You were on 3 times in 1 week. I heard you once in the middle of the night. Tessa the D'Urbervilles, it was.
Oh, yeah.
It was very good. It's so sad.
Oh, it's unbearable.
Sometimes I feel quite cross with Hardy, putting her through the mill like that.
Well, that's how I felt when I was working on it.
But it is terrible.
It's the cuts.
I know it's the cuts.
In 1967, W.H. Auden said that radio drama was a dying art form. But then along came the play which was said to turn things around. Cries from Casement as His Bones Are Brought to Dublin. Fantastic title. The play had a dead narrator, which I'm not always a fan of, but in this instance it worked very well. And there was a row between the government and the BBC.
We can't broadcast that play straight after Bloody Sunday.
It's not straight after.
It's a year.
A year is not straight after.
It's too fresh.
If you leave it any longer, it won't be fresh enough.
And the BBC won this fight. And somehow there was a feeling that this play, that this one play had revived the form. And at the same time, the BBC had managed to assert their independence, to live to fight another day. I don't know what Auden would say about what's going on right now. I don't even know what I'm allowed to say about it.
July 2023. My eldest son, Joe, has finished his A-levels and is living a hedonistic summer while my younger son, Isaac, resentfully still has to go to school. And I am trying to write a play for Radio 3, which celebrates 100 years of radio drama. And I am struggling. 75 minutes to cover 100 years. It's impossible. The play is recording imminently at Broadcasting House in Studio 60A. And it's not finished. And I'm panicking when I get a phone call.
Hello?
Saying my mum has had a fall and that she's in hospital. Can you hear me? Can you? Mum? She looks terrible. She looks like she's been beaten up because she smashed her face when she fell. I don't know what to do with myself. Except wait. And wait.
Hey.
Oh, Joe. Oh, thanks for coming.
Of course. Yeah, of course. Jesus.
I know. Look at her. Look at her.
Oh, Nan.
Thank you for coming.
You stop saying thank you. Are you okay?
Yeah.
Is she going to be okay?
I don't know.
She's not dying.
No, I mean, no. Are you really hungover?
Yeah.
I don't want you to spend the whole summer getting smashed.
I won't.
You need your liver. Did you know that?
Yeah, of course I know that.
Just slow down a bit.
Okay.
Promise?
I promise.
We're there for hours, me and Joe. She won't wake up. Everyone keeps saying that she's fine, but she won't wake up. Joe has his headphones in. He has a 95-hour playlist on Spotify. He listens to everything and anything. His world, an explosion of sound.
What are you listening to?
What?
What are you listening to?
A radio play.
You're not.
I am.
Why?
Why not?
I bet it's not one of mine.
No, it's not. I don't like listening to your stuff.
I know you don't.
It feels weird, like, almost creepy.
Oh, thanks.
Can I go back to it?
Sure.
Where am I?
You know exactly where you are.
I really don't.
This place is very familiar to you.
It's really not. Why do you keep saying that?
Once your brain has settled down, you'll see.
See what?
That you know exactly where you are.
Listen, I don't like this. I don't like it at all. I was just in my bed, minding my own business, fast asleep, dreaming of, you know, I don't know. Man City winning the treble. They did win the treble, why?
In 2023.
Yeah, but they did win it.
That was nearly 1,000 years ago.
Yeah, but they did win it, didn't they?
We didn't bring you here to fight about a 1,000-year-old football match.
What did you bring me here for?
You know why we brought you here.
Oh my God, you are so annoying.
You just need to look around you. Really look.
Where are my arms? And where are my legs?
We had to take them away, as part of the process.
What?
But it's not as bad as it seems, because we've given you something better.
What could be better than my arms and my legs?
You have new abilities now. You've swapped them.
For my arms and my legs?
Yes.
Well, I would have liked to make that choice for myself, thanks very much.
Well, we don't all get to choose our destiny, do we? Well,
apparently not. What's that noise?
There's just one last stage of the process.
Is that...
What?
I thought the bleeping from the hospital was in the play.
I like it when that happens. Is the play any good?
Maybe. Yeah, I quite like it.
What's it about?
It seems like it's very dystopian.
Oh, I don't like dystopia.
I know you don't.
I need more optimism and emotion.
There can be emotion in dystopia.
Yeah, but it's always anger, and the characters are so cold.
Mum, you've got to get over this anti-dystopia thing. I think there's a reason why people want those stories right now. They need those stories, because the future's terrifying for us.
You mean for your generation?
Well, yeah, for all of us. But you lot will be dead so much sooner.
You're right. You're completely right, of course.
Nan's awake.
What? Mom?
Hey, Nan.
Mom, are you okay? How do you feel?
Oh, I feel fine.
Fine?
Yeah, I do.
Can I get you some water, Nan?
Oh, that's a good idea, Jo.
What is wrong with you two?
What do you mean?
We're sitting there like you're at a bloody funeral.
Did you just swear, Nan?
She did.
No, I didn't.
You did, you did.
You look like you've been in a fight, Nan.
Do I? Oh, well, that's good.
It's not good, it's not good, it's not good at all.
Well, I've always wanted to be in a fight, you see.
Have you really? Why?
I wish I'd fought more in my life.
You gave us a scare. You scared us half to death.
But I'm all right. I'm fine. I'm fit as a fiddle. Look at me.
Where are you? Where are you right now? Are you in your kitchen making toast? Or are you on a train or in a car? The way we listen has changed so much, we don't gather around the wireless anymore, do we? We're out and about, doing stuff. We can walk on the beach and listen to a ghost story. I did that recently, and the ghost story seemed to merge with the sea and the darkening sky, and I found myself entirely alone and suitably afraid. It was magic. Radio at its best. The play was by Sebastian Bachkiewicz. I hope you already know his work. I hope you already know all the gorgeous writers who do such wonderful work in radio. Sarah Daniels, Al Smith, Roy Williams, Sebastian, Debbie Tucker Green, Nick Warburton, and tons more. And if you don't know them already, go and find them. Now. Today. One last thing. To the boy born in Torquay in 1948, if you're listening. Please, please, when the play is over, and it's nearly over now, if you possibly can, pick up the phone. It would mean so much if she could hear from you. If she could just hear you. Hear your voice. Sorry, just one more last thing. I want to play you the last scene of the spaceship play because I love it. And it's a good one to end on, I think.
Mum!
Hello. Hello, darling.
You came back.
I came back.
How?
I fought and I didn't give up. And we found a wormhole.
Like Einstein.
Just like Einstein.
That's what you always say to me. Never give up.
Yes.
Can we have chips for tea?
We can have anything you like.
In Come Closer Now, Annie was played by Rebecca Staton, Connie and Jane by Rhiannon Needs, and Farley by Joseph Kloska. The older Jane was played by Jessica Turner, the younger Jane by Maisie Avis, and Michael by Josh Brian Jones. Dan was played by Don Gillet, Nora by Kitty O'Sullivan, Joe by Tyler Cameron, and the boy by Milton Dighton. Come Closer Now was written by Katie Himms, and the director was Anne Isker. It was a BBC audio production for Radio 3.
The Rugby World Cup.
Once more, long pass, and what a start for Wales!
Catch
catch all of the action.
Over it goes, and England lead by 6 in Marseille.
Get full match commentary of every home nation game and many more on 5 Live.
It's on now for Scotland.
Try number 12. What a statement from Ireland.
And follow the biggest stories from the tournament with Rugby Union Daily.
The effort that he has put in is something really quite special.
It ignited a different type of creativity to how they're going to win the game.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
You're listening to BBC Radio 3. It's 9:15 and time now to join Hannah French for more music from the recordings featured by Andrew McGregor on yesterday morning's Record Review programme.
Hello, good evening, welcome to Record Review Extra, where we start with keyboard music by Johann Sebastian Bach, as you've probably never heard it before.